Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It's always a pleasure to welcome you to the platform where we have a lot of fun, good conversation. Don't forget to do the things that you do to make me smile. That is, give us a 5-star rating on any of those podcast platforms. Share us on social media and certainly do that download thing because it makes me feel all yummy inside when you do. I'm excited to have a conversation today with my longtime buddy, Rick Tyler, who is no stranger to the land of crazy. And I'm not just talking about politics, being out in the world of communication sometimes can be a crazy dance in and of itself, regardless of the party. But Rick is co-founder of Foundry Strategies, a political, strategic, and communication consulting firm, and was a senior member of Senator Ted Cruz's 2016 campaign. He's was for a good portion of his early political career a key member of former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich's team, as both a spokesman and an advisor. He is also a buddy of mine at MSNBC, where he serves as a political analyst. And his book, Still Right, An Immigrant-Loving, Hybrid-Driving, Composting American, makes the case for conservatism. It's out now, folks. I highly recommend you pick it up. Rick, welcome back to the playground, baby.
Hey, it's great to be here, Michael. I like to think of myself, you know, shorthand is just Michael Steele's understudy. That's all you need to, that's how you introduce me.
Okay, yeah, we'll go with that and see how that works. You know, look, I'm coming to you knocking. Can you guys use one more brother at the Foundry Strategies? Mm-hmm. Brother could use some work right now.
We would double our workforce if you did that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how it is at the Steel Group. So look, there's a lot I want to get to you about because there have been a number of truths that have come home for the GOP and for the country, certainly for Democrats. Let's start, though. I would like to just, before we get into some of the nitty gritties that we've seen play out with the, January 6th commission, the selection specifically of Cheney and Kinzinger and others and other events like that. What's your big top of the line broad view of the current state of politics as we see both domestic agendas like the infrastructure bill getting passed, but also the democracy narrative unfolding now that the commission's underway and the politics that seem to be roiling beneath that for both parties?
Well, let me start by saying that partisan politics is as old as the country itself. But the nature of which, to the degree to which we put partisan politics ahead of the interest of governing and the interest of the country has reached, hopefully, its apex. And the way I describe it, Michael, is let's say we're at a baseball game and it's the World Series and it's the seventh game and it's going to decide it, right? And there's two outs and, you know, pitcher pitches the ball and the ball's hit and there's a runner on third and he's coming in the home and you know it's unclear whether he's safe or out from any of the fans' perspective from the TV audience, but the umpire is called an out, right? And so we have to sort of say, well, okay, let's see. But now we have instant replay. So let's set the instant replay. And let me put that instant replay on the Jumbotron and on everybody's television. We're going to slow it down, right? And everybody's going to see, we'll call it Jumbotron for the sake of this truth. We'll call it Jumbotron equals truth.
Right.
Right. And then right there on the Jumbotron, everybody can see the truth. And the truth is he's out.
Right.
But it doesn't matter. The truth doesn't matter, you see, because to half the fans in that stadium, that was a really terrible call. And to the other half of the stadium, that was a terrific and the right call.
Right.
Because the truth doesn't matter. It just matters, does this help my team or does this hurt my team? Mm-hmm. And that's where we are in Republican politics today, because you would think that for all the rhetoric that the Republican Party, and you and I have been members of the Republican Party a long time, and you played a significant, very significant roles in the Republican Party. And you would think that given all of our back the blue, law and order, the Constitution, all of that, that we'd come down really hard on an insurrection. I'm just saying.
Like, right.
We would come down really hard on it. And we would say, we need to know the truth about this, regardless of how it's going to turn out. Now, the Republicans have played this from a political, raw political perspective so badly, because instead of just appointing their members and getting on with it and getting it done and over with, because that's in their interest to do, because it's not going to reflect well on them. I don't think it's going to reflect well on anybody, frankly, because it's the whole institution that got attacked. It wasn't just the Republicans or just the Democrats. They weren't chanting. They were chanting lynch Mike Pence, right? The hang Mike
right,
Pence.
Right, right. What a hang Pence. Yeah, exactly.
That's what they were saying. And the last time I checked, he was still a Republican. And so
a conservative one at that.
Yeah. And so
not just a Republican, a conservative.
He's had a long record. And Mike Pence, frankly, has been one of my greatest disappointments in his fealty to Trump. But so in all that, so you'd think this party would figure out, you know, how to get this beyond us, do the right thing, figure out what happened, and have an interest in protecting the institution of Congress, which is the job of the Capitol Police, which utterly failed. Like, nobody could say it didn't fail. And there was an intelligence failure, and that intelligence failure didn't get through to the leaders of the Congress, which is supposed to, its job is to protect its own institution. It utterly failed to do that. And we can, and there's lots of blame to go around. But now, okay, so Donald Trump gets unelected in a fair and free election, as far as I can tell, over and over again. But I'm asking myself today, I actually went through the whole list yesterday, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, on the issue of immigration, from the Trump administration to the Biden administration, do you know what policies have actually changed, like literally changed?
Nothing's changed.
No, there might be more rhetoric toward care and compassion, and that we aren't going to separate children from, but basically the policy is the same.
Afghanistan.
You see, Trump said he was going to get all the troops out of Afghanistan. Biden is actually doing it. So you would think Trump supporters would be like, this Biden guy's great. He's doing everything we want to do, right? He's keeping the immigration policy the same. He's getting the troops out of Afghanistan. He hasn't done a single thing to alter the nature of our trade relationship with China. Like, nothing's advanced. It's exactly where it was.
We're looking on foreign policy
and the budget. Did I talk about the budget? The budget. We're going to pass. Bernie Sanders wanted $6 trillion. He gets 3.5. So I guess the progressives are really upset with him, except they're going to pass the world's largest. We say that every time, and that's true. The world's largest budget for any country in any nation in all of history, right? And the Republicans have no leg to stand on in terms of saying, oh, we're spending too much money. Give me a break, because Trump passed every budget of his, spent more money than was ever spent on any government in human history. So there's no leg. So essentially that policy of spend is essentially, it's the same. And have we repealed corporate tax cuts that everybody's up? No, they're all the same, right? So what is it? I'm just trying to immigration, the same. Foreign policy, largely the same. Budget, the same. Oh, infrastructure. Remember, Trump wanted to do this huge infrastructure bill, and for whatever he got done, didn't want to get it done. he didn't get it done, but he said he always wanted it. And now Biden actually got it passed just yesterday through the House and Senate. So Trump supporters should be, way to go. We got our infrastructure bill. But no, this is a bad infrastructure bill. Not because Biden did it. Not because it's a bad infrastructure bill. We could argue about the details. But because Biden did it.
Right.
So I'm just saying, in this ironic, so we miss, you and I are used to this. We're just going to make everybody mad. We'll make the Republicans mad by comparing Biden to Trump, and we're going to make the Trump supporters mad by comparing Trump to Biden. That's fine. Tell me how they're different, and I'll try to be with you. But to me, it's status quo. Oh, by the way, they say that Trump mucked up the whole coronavirus, and he did, and that's demonstrable. And now we have the CDC. We're all over the place, right? Because we had this bifurcated, like we were going to have half the country wear masks and half the country not wear masks, right? And the ones who we tell to wear masks are the ones who weren't wearing the masks in the first place, and the ones who are most resistant to getting the virus that protects them from getting the virus in the first place, so they wouldn't need a mask. And so do you think the people who are suddenly unvaccinated are going to say, oh my gosh, the science says I got to wear a mask, I'm going to wear a mask. We're going to have half the country with masks and half the country without masks. Like what kind of, from a healthcare standpoint of view of policy, it's ridiculous. From a communications policy, it is utterly incompetent that we ever came up with this idea we're going to have two classes of people. Because the people who are unvaccinated, if they're going to wear a mask, they're going to be subject to ridicule. Hey, why won't you get vaccinated, right? That's why they're not going to wear a mask.
Well, you hit
on are we safer? No.
Right, exactly. You're not, and that's part of the interesting dynamic at play here, which says to me just how poisoned our politics has become. You touched on a number of things that kind of open up the conversation now around exactly what it is we're looking at. The sense of tribalism to me is what permeates everything. It is, as you noted at the beginning, my team, it's for, when I look at the scoreboard and I look at the Jumbotron and I'm seeing the replay and the facts are telling me he's out, but my team, damn it, that was a bad call. We should have gotten that call. We should have won that. In fact, we did win that. There's this effort to convince oneself to an alternate view of the facts and to begin to believe those things. So it's fascinating to me with this new AP NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll that came out that showed that 15% of Republicans approve of the way Biden is handling his job. 66% continue to say the Democrat was illegally elected president of the United States. And more, but then when you dig down and look at it, what the poll also exposes is that of all the Republicans that were polled in this, only 41% of them, well, let me do it this way. The Republicans say they want President Trump to have influence over the GOP, right? That he is the prescription we need for success in the future. But here's the rub. When pressed, only 41% say they're optimistic about that future for the GOP with Trump in the front of it. Just 13% say they are very optimistic. And one third, 33%, say they are pessimistic about that. So if Trump is this savior for the GOP, he's the go-to, he's the guru, he's the guy who knew better than any other Republican before him, even though Trump is not a Republican. Let's restate that for the record. He's registered, but he's not ideologically, philosophically, or otherwise. I guess the question, if he's that guy, why do they see him as the point when they look at the future with him on the tip of that spear going, well, you know, this could be a hot mess. I'm not that excited. I'm not that interested. What's going on inside the party that lends oneself to want Trump but not be optimistic about having Trump?
here's what's going on. This is the only way I've described it. Is Trump supporters, and to some degree, the Republican Party writ large, not all of them. And there's always been this division in the party where there's, and it's usually the conservative faction is upset.
Put a pin in that, because I'm going to drill down on something on that division in a moment. But you just opened up the right door. Go ahead.
Yeah. So first of all, there's this there's no ideological coherence. Like, people don't understand what a conservative is anymore. Like, all the policies. The ones I'll name conservative policies, like Biden's policies, none of those are my policies because they're not conservative policies, but they happen to be Trump's policies. They were all Trump's policies, and it's not conservative. Yet people will run around and say they're a conservative because Trump supports something, which is a little like chewing on a piece of red raw meat and claiming you're vegan. It just doesn't comport, right? But here's what's going. Look, to be fair, there's always been this anti-establishment component in both parties, right?
Sure.
And the anti-establishment component believes, and they still believe, and they're not wrong in this, in that they've always been told and believed that, you know, if you work hard, play by the rules, and you know, you're fair, and you'll get to live your American dream. That's always been what we've been told for really our entire lives. And it is the hope of America. And to some degree, it's still true. But there are a lot of Americans who don't believe that's true because they have been working. It's not that they're not working hard. They are working hard. And their ends are not meeting. And they see, exploited a lot by the left, but, you know, there's a wealth gap, which is certainly true. And they see that, you know, I'm working hard and I'm not getting ahead. And Washington is screwing me over, or somebody's screwing me over. And it's all encapsulated in the message, which was brilliant, of the wall, which is, you know, I'm going to build a wall, Mexico's going to pay for it. In that one statement, Trump has covered everything. The jingoistic notion that we can't have people of color coming from the South, because why? They're going to steal our culture, they're going to change our language, and they're going to lower my wages, and they're going to steal my job.
Right.
But if we just look back at American history, at all the waves of immigration, that's never been true of any immigrant community, not one. Like, when the Jews came, you know, we don't all go to the temple on Saturday, right? And we don't speak, you know, Hebrew. And when the Germans came, we don't speak German. And when the Italians came, we didn't become Catholic. And just on and on and on. With each one of those waves of groups, they've made America better. And we don't even notice them. We don't even notice their last names anymore. Pelosi, Giuliani, these are Italian Americans, right? But, oh, I didn't even think of that. Yeah, because their last names give them away. And now all of a sudden, you know, it's the Muslims and it's the Latinos, particularly from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, because those people are being killed by gangs. So, like, that's why they're coming. They're not coming because, oh, I heard America, you know, has really nice beach. No, they're coming because they're being killed, or they're in danger of being killed, or they don't want their family killed. That's where they're coming. And next time there's a caravan, we ought to send buses. Because actually, if you and I are ever going to collect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, someone's going to have to do all this work. And I don't know who's going to be, because there ain't enough of us. You know, so
right. Yeah. Americans have kind of given up on that idea. I gotta do that? No. So I Trump, can't hire that out?
Yeah, so Trump used this wall as this huge metaphor. And then he put in China's ripping us off. And, like, they all believe that. Because why? Because someone's got to be ripping me off. I'm working hard and it's not happening for me.
Right.
And here's the key, though. America has always looked for a superhero, in that someone who's, you know, good and just and for the American way would go to Washington and, as a good guy, clean it all up. And that's what politicians have run on for years. And guess what? Nobody cleans it up. Trump doesn't do that. He says, I'm going to go to Washington and screw them worse than they screwed all of you. He's like, he didn't go to Washington to be a good guy. He went to Washington to out-corrupt the corrupt. His supporters. So when you say, well, Trump was caught in a lie, did you see that? Here's the facts and here's the lie. And they're like, are you kidding me? Of course he lied, because he's lying to them. And screw them, and good for them.
They're happy
about it. That explains why they're not upset with him lying, because there's a cynical faction that now believes you just got to be more corrupt than the corrupt. And I can't ever accept that, and I can't believe that, and because there's no future in that. And the what I call political binaries, right? each side has a position that the other side claims the other side has a position they don't actually hold. So on immigration, the Democrats say the Republicans want to round everybody up at midnight and deport them tomorrow, right? I don't know a single Republican in the Congress who actually holds that point of view. Like none of them have articulated that point of view.
Right.
And then the Republicans say, well, the Democrats, they want open borders. They want people to cross free will. Except I can't find a single Democrat in the Congress who actually has articulated that point of view.
Right.
And so we play this game. And what's going on in the Virginia elections now? We have this thing called critical race theory. Oh my God, critical race theory is going to ruin the country, going to teach our children to hate America. And we got to stop it. And in my own county, Loudoun County, you know, we got to repeal the school board. I had a guy with a petition, you know, come by the other day, wants me to sign a petition. And I said, do you know something? And he says, what? I said, do you know how many schools are teaching critical race theory in Virginia? And he's like, well, Loudoun is. I said, let me tell you something, pal. Critical race theory is not taught in Loudoun, in any school district, in any county, in any of Virginia or any county, any district in America. Now, it may be taught in some Harvard courses because it's been around since the 1970s. But in terms of a curriculum in the school, it ain't happening. Get out of here with your petition. Because all it is another fake conspiracy.
Well, that's just it. I got into it with this guy, same kind of conversation. Yeah. And I asked him, I didn't even ask him if he knew where it was being taught. I asked him, do you know what it is? And he couldn't answer the question. Right. He started babbling all this bullshit. And I was like, dude, you have no idea what it is. First off, like you just said, it has been around for over 40 years, almost 50 years. It is a higher level graduate course that's taught. I mean, it is like, even among graduate students, it is a very small percentage of graduate students who deal with critical race theory.
So 38 people in the world have learned to hate America.
Right. All of whom are writing dissertations and papers, and it's a theory.
Right.
But it does, you raise, and it does speak to a broader issue that we see playing out right now. So for example, in this AP NORC poll, one of the things that the authors found was that, you know, as they said, quote, Republican leaders have spent much of this year trying to rile up voters, pointing to concerns about inflation and stoking culture wars over issues, including immigration, like you raised, election conspiracy theories and critical race theory, an academic framework that examines history through the lens of racism. So what the Republican Party has gotten expert with, and I ran into some of this in 2009 with the Tea Party to a certain extent, was taking small things and exaggerating them into bigger things. And when people, in my experience, tend to do that, it's because of other frustrations that they're responding to and other reactions. And it reminds me of a lot of what animated voters in 16 and again in 20 about Trump. And you put your finger on it. They see him as a fighter. Most of them don't know, to your point, that he's actually there fighting A, for himself, doesn't give a crap about them, B, that his goal is to deconstruct the administrative state. He told us that, which means that all the things that people genuinely do like about government, right? When we're in crunch time and we need help, Donald Trump wants to tear and break all that up, right? But they see him as this fighter going in to exact retribution against a system they think has failed them. So that led me to look at a very interesting piece that was put out by Henry Olson of the Washington Post. He's a columnist for opinion writer for the Washington Post. And he wrote this piece, the GOP has five factions now. They all see a different future for their party. And it really speaks to how the party is kind of reorienting itself. So I'd like to get your thoughts on these. So here are the factions, the old guard. Mm-hmm. These are the folks who don't want to change anything. This is the Liz Cheney wing, the Patrick Toomey wing of the party, where for them and their allies, like in conservative think tanks like Heritage, et cetera, in the academic world, nothing from the last 10 years or so justifies changing the GOP approach to domestic policy. All right. So they're good with where things are. They want to keep perpetuating the narrative around free trade, free markets, et cetera. The adapters. So you have the old guard, Cheney, the adapters. They recognize times are changing, but propose minimal shifts in the party doctrine. And that's when someone like a Nikki Haley comes into play, where they generally support Trump's attempts to control illegal immigration and have a confrontational approach to China. But they tend to, you know, they want some change, but not a whole lot of it. The searchers, like Jim Banks, a Republican from Indiana, they're actively trying to carve out a new space, right? And so they're looking, you know, these are the, you know, the Kevin McCarthy's of the world, you know, are trying to rebrand the GOP as the party of the working class, right? So these folks are, you know, they're trying to sort of adapt or adopt some of the you know, the workman's language on economic issues, for example. Then the reformers are the Rubios, the Cottons, and the Hawleys. You know, they are pretty much, they want a comprehensive rethink of everything that we're doing. They support increases in the minimum wage, government subsidization for domestic, you know, semiconductor manufacturing, returning money collected from tariffs on the Chinese back to middle class taxpayers. So these are the folks who support unions. All right. So they support the unionization of Amazon, for example. The final group are the prophets, and this is where the J.D. Vances of the world come in. They're just radical reformers. They're offered tax hikes on companies that move jobs out of the United States. You know, they have a very strong critique of how the worship of market forces has led to far too many impoverished Americans. So they really, they're at the far end of the spectrum. So you've got these factions that have formed inside the GOP, the old guard, status quo, the adapters, oh, we make some changes, the searchers, hey, let's try something new, the reformers, well, let's just reform the system, and the prophets are like, you know what, let's just kind of go with it. Some would say swing so far, you could wind up standing closer to Democrats than you are Republicans. How do you see these factions playing themselves out with Trump still sitting there as the center ringleader, who, as we've just seen, even on this infrastructure deal today, comes out with an asinine comment about how, you know, this is the worst deal ever in the history of deals, and that, you know, we're going to now primary any Republican who supports it. You know, for a number of these folks, particularly for the reformers and the adapters, this type of deal is a good thing, trying to get us into that space where you can get something done. Because at the end of the day, they like to go into 2022 saying, we bought billions of dollars back to our state to fix the roads and the bridges, et cetera. But with all of these factions, you still have to deal with someone like Trump who's like, no, it's my way or no way.
Well, what's ironic about it is if we go with Henry's five factions, then he's left one out, which is the cult faction of Donald Trump, because Donald Trump supporters don't have a governing ideology.
I was going to ask, that's really the crux of it. I'm glad you framed it that way, because that's really what I was getting at, because there is the cultural cult of personality piece that sort of,
You've heard it before.
Makes
you've heard it
from their supporters. Stuff work.
It's like, well, what is Trump going to do? Well, he has a plan. Well, what's the plan? Well, trust
me. It's coming. Wait for it. It's coming.
It's coming, and you're going to see. You'll see. You'll see. But they can't articulate the plan because they don't know what it is. They just have this trust that there's a plan and that Trump's going to put it forth. And like he will, they say, like someone down the street, you know, they got a sign. Trump is going to be back in office in August.
In
right?
August, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm picking out my uniform for the inauguration. I think I'm going to go with the Speedo and the white socks and sandals, and I will have my flagpole with my pillow on.
Oh, my God, that's a look.
So
Speedo with white socks and sandals.
But here's the thing, Michael, as you were listing off all of those different factions, I see myself in all of them, and here's why. Because conservatism, people would say a conservative is the old guard. That's not actually true.
It's not true.
Conservatism doesn't mean that, you know, you're not, you don't want to change anything. What it means is prove to me that what is what we have now or what you want to bring forth is going to be better than what we have now. And if you can prove that, then we'll move to the new, we'll move to today. But if you can't, now the opposite of that ideology is progressive, which means to move away, generally means move away from God and the Constitution is what I always say. But it's to move away, move forward. So let's just try things until something works. And right. Then they're always trying the next thing, and never give a chance to work. So the conservative is just saying, look, does this work? And there, so the reason I say I see a lot of myself in all of those is because there are so many things that are not working. Like, our tax system does not work. It doesn't help people save. No. It doesn't reward investment. It doesn't reward hard work. It doesn't reward. And so we have class divisions. Now the left wants to. We actually share something in common with the left. I don't want there to be a wealth gap. Nobody. I mean, I don't think anybody does. You want to close the wealth gap. You want the poor to acquire more wealth. But right. That doesn't mean I want the rich to be poorer. I want the poor to have more opportunity to become rich. And that's something you can't show me in any school that people actually. I don't remember in any of my classes taking in a class on how to invest or how the market works or right. How Wall Street. We badger Wall Street all the time, but you know what? Everything we're using today, from this microphone to my nice Rode podcaster here to mm-hmm. to this Macintosh AirBook, those are impossible without Wall Street investment. Like, they don't exist without Wall Street right. investment. Right. Like, half the things you use every day, they don't exist without Wall Street investment. And so we mislead people into what, again, like conservatism, what is capitalism, what is free market? People are so misconstrued, they don't understand what free market is or capitalism. They'll say, oh, well, the corporations and the government helping different, that's not capitalism.
Right.
That's corporatism. That's corrupt.
Very different beast.
And so so if we're going to do a reform and a reset, we need to start with, one, civics education, and we need to start with financial and economic education and the theories of all these things so people can kind of pick and decide. And it's like, you decide, do you want the rich to be poor, or would you rather be, if you're poor, would you rather be rich? I think most people would say, I'd rather be rich.
Yeah, I put it this way, because I really, in a number of ways, having grown up at times on the margins,
same here.
And my mom and dad. My mom was a laundress, mm-hmm. Making minimum wage. Mm-hmm. My dad was a truck driver for the Department of Defense. There were some moments. I remember the conversation in our household about, we may need to get some government cheese to come mm-hmm. in the door to make some ends meet. But the reality of it is, what I've learned, to your very important point, Rick, is the poor in this country, and I think you put it so well, the poor in this country does not wake up every morning going, gee, I think all I want to be today is poor. They don't. No one wants to be poor. Circumstances, good, bad, or otherwise, situations, conditions, all these factors sort of get baked into that. And it goes to a lot of what you're hearing a lot in the Black community especially, but other communities as well, talk about the systemic nature of poverty and how issues like race and class and other indices play a role in perpetuating that poverty. So this idea that you're somehow now the consequence or the response is, well, we want to make the rich just like the poor. Okay, then what? You're right. Let's figure out how we allow the system to lift up and push people out into the economy in a way in which they have a fair shot to realize the dream that they have for themselves. We know the story of those who come here with nothing and make things happen. All right. But we also know the story of those who are already here who can't get things started. And so we have to look holistically, in my view, at the system and see where we can make those changes. And I agree with you. I'm a little bit of all of those factions at any given time, because it is case by case. It is situational. There's some things that, you know, for me, conservatism is less about a policy position. Because I know a lot of Democrats who are pro-life, but are very progressive in everything else that they articulate, right? But they're pro-life. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of Republicans who are pro-choice and very conservative, to use that term again, about what they believe on guns or Second Amendment, or whatever. But for me, conservatism is about preserving the value of something. It is about how you preserve the value of the individual, mm-hmm. the value of that individual's liberties and freedoms under our Constitution. That's for me what conservatism is about. It is a philosophy more than it is a policy. It is a way of looking at the country through the lens of every individual who comprise it, who has a dream, and how do we help them preserve that dream for themselves, that they can pass it on and make it better for the next generation. And I think that the fact that a lot of folks feel they can't do that now is why you see and feel the sort of tension in the body politic, where, and you see it in polling, you've seen it, you've talked about it in the past, where people say, you know, life is not going to be better for my kids than it was for me. And that scares a lot of parents. So from a conservative perspective, I'm like, okay, let's figure out how we can preserve that ideal for that family, that they can make it better for the next generation, who in turn can make it better for the next generation. And I think Trump came in and just basically crapped all over that with this, you know, with these straw dog arguments about a wall and about, you know, and as we saw in the 2018 cycle and again in 2020, all these immigrants pouring across the border to take your job and telling white women in the suburbs they're coming for you. They're moving to your neighborhood. Who's moving to your neighborhood? Baby, I'm already living in your neighborhood. What are you afraid of me for? Right? I'm three doors down from you. What are you talking about?
You know,
I'm already
me of,
here.
One of these network shows, it's called, I think it's called Preppers, right? You know what a prepper uh-huh. is, right? And I love watching that show and how they prepare, right? And I would say I'm a prepper in the sense that I want to be prepared. Like I have a backup generator and I have water when the power, because we live out here in the country. And so right. you know, we want to maintain the comforts, right? And then, but the common theme in all the preppers was when it goes down, the shit goes down and they're, they're coming after you. They bug out to their bug out. They hide. And I'm always thinking, like, who is chasing you? Like,
right.
like, and now, like, everything the preppers said, right? Pandemic, economic collapse, you know, all right. these things. They all happened.
They all happened.
And here I am in the country, right? And the marauders, they never showed up. Like, where are the marauders? Like, they're supposed to be here by now. And government agents are supposed to be chasing me, although I'm not running anywhere. But anyway.
Dude, let me tell you, the last place they're going to come to is your house. The first place they're going to go to is a Target.
Like, I didn't get, like, the whole prepper thing, right? But look, you hit on a lot of very good points. And the division comes down to basically is the function of government and what government can best do. We take individual freedom, I think, in a very misconstrued way, because we talk about individual freedom and the founders were very concerned about individual freedom.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean individual freedom doesn't mean you don't care for your fellow citizen. And it's apparent in the whole mask thing, right? It's my constitutional right not to wear a mask. Okay. But you know, you can infect people and they can get sick. Is that your constitutional right? I don't think it's your
Wait
constitutional
a minute.
Right.
You have a constitution. Okay. So if it's your constitutional right to not wear a mask, is it your constitutional right not to put on your seatbelt? But when you get in your car, what's the first thing you do?
Put on your seatbelt.
Put on your seatbelt, right.
And some would argue.
And that was mandated by law.
That was mandated by law.
You've just been asked to wear a mask.
Yeah, and the reason
there's
the states
mandate by law that you have to wear a mask. Everybody has to wear a mask, right?
Yeah, and the reason the states all adopted is because they were going to take away their federal highway funds, and so they said, "Well, we better get on the ball."
You know, we'll get on the ball, right?
We get on the ball, and guess what? It saved a lot of lives, and so there's always going to be this balance between what we do corporately, right? And what we do individually. We can't be, everybody just can't be an individual and claim individual rights. We have to be aware of our fellow citizens, and we have to take care of our federals. I put it this way, you know, the conservatives always rail about, you know, welfare and too much government spending and helping the poor and all this. Okay, that's great. Do you know if just every other person or half the country, and it's not even that, Michael, it's like if 1 in 20, which is what right. it is, 1 in 10, and right. what it, which is what it is now, right? But if let's say half the people actually decided, I'm going to help one other person, not 20 people, not two, not 1,000, just one other person, we wouldn't need welfare.
Right. We wouldn't.
We wouldn't need it because.
And, by the way, that just for some folks out there.
But half the country doesn't actually need help, right? It's really a small number. But here's the thing, I'll tell you a quick short story. I had a friend of my wife and I. She became homeless and she lived with us for a while.
Right.
And she lost her home, and she was actually very bright, very smart. She had been a registered nurse for years. But she had mental health issues. Like right. she was not capable of holding a job. She was never going to hold a job. Like it was like you could assess her and say, this person is never going to. She was always going to need help. It wasn't just like we can help her now and then she'll be better. No, she was never going to get better, Michael.
Right.
She was always going to need help. And here's the thing. I had another friend of mine who I just happened to run across, and I said, you know, he had diabetes, but he was perfectly capable of working, a very smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he just gave up, and he just said, well, I filed for disability, and I'm living on disability. And I'm like, there's something, like, you can do something. And you know why he got disability like that? Because he's smart and competent. He doesn't have a mental health issue. He could fill out all that crappy paperwork that I had mm-hmm. to hire a lawyer to do,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
right? Because I couldn't even do it. And so why can't my friend who is homeless get help from the government? Because she can't manage the barriers to actually get help.
Right.
And my other friend is perfectly capable of working. He can get help. Why? Because he can fill out all the forms because he's really smart.
Right.
There's something
right.
wrong with that system.
Yeah.
People are always going to, we have to recognize as conservatives that people are always going to need help. But I don't want these other people clogging up the system so my friend can't get help.
Right.
You follow me?
I got you. No,
yeah.
I agree with that 100%. And that speaks to, I think, a lot of how the system weighs down on individuals to the point that we see a retaliatory response that's manifest through the political avatar of Donald Trump. And that's how and why a white female mother of two living in New England, divorced, when she looks at Donald Trump, says he's just like me, because what she sees herself as is fighting for her kids, fighting for her family, trying to make those ends meet. Donald Trump gives rhetorical legitimacy to that fight, and they latch on to that because it's the first time they've actually heard someone who speaks to that. Bill Clinton says, I feel your pain. But what Trump did was he said, I'm going to speak to your pain because I feel it, but I don't say anything about it, right? You know, but when I speak to that, what you did in the example you gave was you acted on someone else's pain. You stepped in. You did what a lot of these, you know, card-carrying Christians out here who are embracing something I don't even recognize as Christianity anymore. What you did was you lived out the gospel by taking someone in and helping them. You didn't just said, I feel your pain. You just didn't go to someone else and say, hey, gee, I have a friend who's in a certain way. and you know, talked about that pain, what you did was you acted on it. And for me, that's the ultimate, conservative. And even take that label off. That is the ultimate human thing to do, is to act. And that's something that we've stopped doing.
Well, since you've raised it to a theological discussion, let me use this example.
I can't help myself.
During hurricane, during Superstorm Sandy, right? You remember that? Mm-hmm. And
very
the,
well.
The city of New York had decided that they were going to purchase turkeys for people, you know, in these devastated communities for the holidays. I don't know whether we can cook the turkeys, but anyways, it doesn't matter.
Right.
And of course, the news did a heartwarming story and everybody getting their turkeys. And look, I'm fine with them getting the turkeys. I'm not upset that they got their turkeys. It's fine. It's good use of taxpayer. Go ahead, give them the turkeys. But it's not a heartwarming story. And the reason is because the taxpayers, through compulsion of taxation, paid for the turkeys. But nowhere did someone say, I'm going to sacrifice on my own and go and help this one person, because people don't just need financial assistance. They need holistic healing. They need, they need people to minister to them. And the government can't, the government cannot minister to you no matter what it does. It could give you a home. It could write you a check. It could do all kinds, but it cannot minister to you as a human being. We're supposed to minister to each other as human beings. And that's why I say, if a small percentage of the world would just say, I just need to help some, not help the world, not write a check to United Way, not that that's a bad thing to do. And they do a lot of great work. That's, don't misunderstand. I'm just saying, in your own way, what can you do to help one other individual, just one other individual, and say, I'm going to take this on because I care about that person and I can make a difference in their life. And it's so rewarding and satisfying, as opposed to writing a check to United Way for a little while, but you know, it's not, and that's the question about what government can do. And I hear the left saying, you know, the government can do so many things for the poor. And that is true. It's not true. And I don't think the motivations are good. I won't say they're pure, but I say they're good. Mm-hmm. But is that the best way, as a functioning society, as a healthy society, is just give money to the government? Because what the outcrop of that is, well, when my parents get old, I'm just going to put them in a government home because, after all, I'll pay my taxes. And they're going to go, not, I take care of mom. She's going to live with us in her final years. It's going to be a huge sacrifice. It's going to disrupt our lives, but I'm going to do it because she's my mother.
That's right.
Right. And
that's
many
right.
families will do that anyway. But we never want to get into that mindset where, well, this is the government's job.
Yeah. All right, theology class is over. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to wrap up with a little bit more politics with my buddy Rick Tyler right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele Podcast. We're having a great discussion with my man, Rick Tyler, co-founder of Foundry Strategies. So, Rick, let's bring it all home around what we've seen happening in the past few days. The January 6th Commission has launched itself, and we now have two Republicans on the committee commission appointed by the speaker in Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, both serving on this commission. The opening with four Capitol Hill police and DC police officers who were representative of what happened to police that day, who were representative of how Capitol Hill police specifically are now seeing and viewing the men and women that they protect on Capitol Hill, who seemingly don't give a rat's ass about them on the Republican side, at least. What's your takeaway from the January 6th commission, and how do you see this playing out as this narrative unfolds over the next 7, 8, 9 months? Because this, as you know, Benny Thompson, the commission chair, said, this is going to go into next year. This is not going to be done one and done by December 31st. So they're going to have some ramifications going into the next political cycle as well. How do you assess things right now on that front?
Without being cynical, I think people are too cynical that this is not going to make any difference. Because I don't know that there's anything that most people don't know about what happened on January 6th, and they take different distinct views of it, which some have been painted in the extreme. And, you know, I contend, because I recognize what an insurrection looks like, it's a violent overthrow of a legitimate government.
Right.
Pure and simple. And this was a violent overthrow, an attempted violent overthrow of a legitimate government. And that is played out in the testimony, where you hear people saying they are going to kill the vice president, that they are going, there are people who are organized. There was a military component to this. Not everybody. A lot of people were just there. But it was a violent overthrow of the government, and it should have sparked outrage as a nation, the way Oklahoma City did, frankly.
Right.
The way Bill Clinton saved his presidency, actually, from the Oklahoma City bombing in his reaction to the Oklahoma City bombing, because the country was shocked that a domestic terrorist, and I don't see the ones who broke into the Capitol. I'll give people a pass who thought they were just attending, you know, a wild rally, and who didn't actually go into the Capitol or beat on, you know, law enforcement officers. But there were a significant number of people who did go into the Capitol and did beat on law enforcement officers, did break into offices, and did threaten. Those are insurrectionists. Those are domestic terrorists. I don't know what else to call them. I don't have any other nice names for them.
Right.
And, you know, and Charlie Kirk, who's a well-known, you know, he calls himself a conservative, tweeted out the other day, you know, are we going to have a moment of silence for the woman who lost her life? I don't recall her name. I'm not even sure I want to recall her name, who was shot that day and she died. And I tweeted back, no, Charlie, we don't honor domestic terrorists with moments of silence. We dedicate resources to defeating them.
Right.
And sometimes they get shot. And it's tragic that she got shot, and it's sad that she got shot, but she got shot because she decided that she was going to participate in an insurrection. And I just think that people, we don't have any leadership who's defining the times for us, where people say, you know what, that's right, this was an insurrection that can never happen again. This commission is important. And don't get me wrong. Look, Democrats are politicizing this. Give me a break. They want it because they know it, it provides them a story going into the, into the 2022
Absolutely.
Election.
Yeah.
But look, this country is divided. The Senate is 50-50. The Democrats didn't have an overwhelming victory in the last election cycle. They broke even. The same with the House. You know, they marginally have control. They may likely lose control in the next year. And the whole system, we have to decide as a people, do we want to just keep picking a team and playing partisan politics? Or do we actually want our elected representatives to govern? Because they're not governing. You can't govern under these circumstances, because the way the system is built, now if you want to change the system, then we really can have an insurrection. But the system is built on one word only. Like, you're going to take the whole constitutional republic of the United States and all its everything that was put together by the founders, it functions on one word, compromise. And we didn't want to say that word. Remember, John Boehner wouldn't say that word for years. Like, he wouldn't say the C word, right? And it's based on compromise. It means, you give me a little of this, I'll give you a little of that. We'll get it done. Everybody will be happy and we'll move on, which is ultimately what happened with the infrastructure bill. But if we don't compromise, nothing gets done.
Yeah, I was going to say with respect to that, because there is, you know, we had at least 2 years of infrastructure week in the last 2 years of the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And now we,
week.
Right. You know, every week was infrastructure week. So, but here we are now, we've got the deal done. You've got 17 Republicans who signed off on it, including, Mitch McConnell. And so there is this ability to kind of turn that corner when we need to. What is it then? Why is this so hard at this time? Is it because the parties are just sort of jockeying for marginal control, because that's the country doesn't seem bent on giving either one of them absolute control, where you have a 60 seat majority in the House, I mean, in the Senate, and, you know, a 70 seat or 50 seat majority in the House itself. So you got, you know, this in the Senate, rather. So where do you see this ability to sort of get the nation's business done if the compromise that's required under the rules of our republic, the leadership just doesn't want to do that? I mean, because we stop and think about it, Rick, this is rare. This is rarefied air we're breathing right now with this infrastructure bill. I mean, we still have voting rights, which I think is far more important than the infrastructure bill, because it goes to the fundamental rights as a citizen. You know, I may not see infrastructure work done in my neighborhood, right? But I'm going to go vote. So,
Michael, you'll see infrastructure work in your. They're going to pave your road again and again and again. And again. How does that happen?
Brothers got connect. What can I say? But no, it's just, you know what I'm saying. It's so there are some things that are a priority, yet we're not prioritizing them. There are some things that require compromise in this current political environment. We're not in a situation where Democrats have control of the House for 40 years like they did between 54 and 94, or Republicans have, you know, the national advantage in presidential elections as they did for a significant period of time. Clearly, the country is saying one thing. Our politics is doing something else. How do you assess it?
I mean, there's a couple of things going on in this historic period, which actually began in 1995 with the Republican Revolution.
Right.
And a lot of liberals and Democrats like to look back and say that's when this all this terrible things happened. Well, that's not exactly true. I mean, we had a man nearly caned to death on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Or was it the House? I can't remember now. But that's gone on for years and years. Ever since 1995, every single election, the majority, which is power in the Congress, whether in the House or the Senate, has been at stake in both houses every time, every single time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is about sheer power. And what's lacking is leadership and the ability for a leader to articulate what I would call a sustainable governing philosophy, meaning how do you rule? And I don't mean that in a negative sense. How do you govern as a majoritarian party over the long haul, where the majority of the party says either, you know, we really want the Democrats to be in charge, or we really want to be the Republicans to be in charge. And here's what's lacking. Not only is there vision lacking to explain to the country why that's important. The vision is lacking for what does it look like? What does the country look like under the vision is like the entire vision is lacking. There is no vision. And the media also has and when I say media, I mean all the talk radio,
everything,
network, everything, podcasts, they'll have a financial stake, an adverse financial stake in exploiting the divisions, right? You know, like plane landed with $5 billion worth of gold and landed safely and everything's okay. Like that doesn't get reported, right? Always these terrible things get reported. And if you could have a lead and always be a leader, and we never know who it is. Like no one would have predicted Reagan would be a leader. No one would have predicted Lincoln would have been a leader. In the same way, no one would have saw Barack Obama coming forward as the Democratic nominee. Like you wouldn't have seen that. Like so leaders emerge. You can't pick them out immediately. They become apparent over time. And if you get a governing majority but the governing majority, see, here's the hard part. This is really hard. The first part is simple. People say, oh, it's so hard to move the Congress. So hard to count the votes. We don't have the votes. Oh, we can't do it. We can't. It's not. Congress is not full of leaders. They're full of followers.
Exactly.
What you need is a person who can speak to the country, because when the country changes its collective mind, as it did in 1995, by the way, because welfare reform is a really hard thing to argue against, because the left was saying, you know, the grandmothers are going to eat dog food. Everybody's going to go out in the street, you know,
right.
stealing kid, you know, food out of kids' mouth, all that stuff, right? But the country decided that welfare, the way it was structured, was causing generational poverty. And that was a worse thing than what people, they didn't have that in mind. So 101 Democrats actually voted for welfare reform. And Bill Clinton, after vetoing twice, actually signed it. And he was going to change, remember, he was going to change government. Was, you know, Bill Clinton stood at the 1996 Chicago Convention in his renomination speech. You'll remember this well.
And yes.
And he took credit for 13 Republican-initiated congressional bills that got passed in the law, which he signed. I got to give him credit. He signed them. They were all stemmed from one document. It was called the Contract with America.
That's right.
So imagine this. A Republican Party with a leader came up with a set of ideas that they wanted to pass, sold it to the country. The country said yes, gave them a majority. They passed it. A Democrat signed it, goes to his own convention against, after his entire party, including him, campaigned against the Contract with America, calling it the Contract on America, right? You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And took credit for 13 items that stem from the Contract with America. And the crowd, which were all the Democratic activists, were cheering. We did it. We did it. We did it.
All right.
Now that is a political victory. That is how you get things done. But you have to convince the country. And that's what takes time. And that's what no one's doing, because we get stuck in these political binaries, which is, you know, they're Democrats are all evil or Republicans are all evil. They're not all evil. They're all partially evil, but they're not all evil. They're people that we can work with, that we can compromise, and we shouldn't put up with the nonsense like the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world, who's an embarrassment not only to Georgia, not only to Northeast Georgia, but to the entire nation. And so, if our party has to recognize, or the Republican Party has to recognize, that we need to restore leadership and go about convincing the country that we have an attractive governing philosophy. Go and sell it.
Go and sell it. Rick Tyler, he's the man. I love him. Rick Tyler, co-founder of Foundry Strategies. Really appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us, and just giving us another perspective on some of the crazy we know is American politics today, man. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Michael.
You can follow Rick on Twitter at Rick W. Tyler. Check him out, and certainly check out his new book, Still Right, An Immigrant-Loving, Hybrid-Driving, Composting American Makes the Case for Conservatism. Is out now. Get it on Amazon or wherever you get your good fine books from. And don't forget to show some love to your host. I really appreciate it when you guys do that download thing. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Until next time, get vaccinated. Stop playing around. Stop being silly. Stop being crazy. Wear the mask just to protect yourself. Yeah, it's a pain sometimes, but you know, at the end of the day, you want to be here for Thanksgiving. Enjoy the rest of the summer. I'll catch you guys soon. Take care.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.